My name is Janelle Mathias. I'm at Ledyard Apartments in Hanover, New Hampshire. I am doing a Zoom interview with Jean Thibodex, who is in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Today is October 24th, 2021, and this is an interview for the Dartmouth Black Lives Oral History Project. Hello, Jean. Thank you so much for joining me today. First, I'd like to learn a little bit more about your childhood. Can you please state when and where you were born?
Okay, yes, I was born in a small hamlet in southwest Louisiana, and the hamlet is called Mallet, M-A-L-L-E-T, Louisiana, and I'm in my office now, and the copy machine is in the background, so let that okay, it's finishing. It's a small hamlet. It's a farming community. My father was a small farmer, 40 acres, and he planted cotton and corn and sweet potatoes and rice. And I grew up in that community. It's a very Catholic community for 13 years before moving to Lake Charles, Louisiana, which we call the big city, which is approximately 75,000 people. The parish, which you all call the county, is approximately 200,000. So my early formative years were in the small town, small hamlet. There were no stoplights, there were no street signs. There was only one Catholic church, which was the gathering point for the community. Okay. I went to elementary school there, and we moved when I was in the ninth grade to Lake Charles, Louisiana.
And when was that? When did you move?
In 1964.
Okay. And prior to 1964, did your family always reside in that small hamlet?
Yes.
Okay. And you said your father was a farmer. How was that like when you were growing up?
I'm sorry.
And you said your father owned 40 acres?
Correct, 40 acres.
And how was that growing up with such big lands?
Well, we farmed the land. We fed ourselves. I was one of 11 siblings, and we all worked. We all thought that school started in the end of September because we were working in the fields before going to a school. I really didn't work that hard in the fields because my older brothers and sisters protected me from that. I did a lot of reading in those days. I think I read every book in the library twice. And so it taught us the value of community because everyone knew each other, and it taught us the value of hard work. My father was also a laborer who worked on construction projects in Lake Charles, Louisiana. So he would get up in the mornings at 3 or 4 o'clock, catch a bus to Lake Charles, then arrive back in Mallet, the small hamlet, around 5 or 5:30, and from there went to work in the fields. I just thought that was natural. That was fathers did. I later learned that was a hell of a sacrifice to do that. But I was naive, I was young, and I said, well, that is what fathers do. And so it taught me also the value of love and the value of giving to your family, protecting your family. Think about it, you're getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're catching a bus to work in the industrial areas of Lake Charles. Lake Charles is an industrial petrochemical community. And then having to come back and work in the fields from 5:30 to 6 to 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night.
Yeah, that was a sacrifice. You mentioned that you're one of 11 siblings. Were you the youngest?
No, I was number 9. I have sisters who are twins who are 3 years younger than me. I am 72, and well, not quite. I'll be 72 in 10 days. And my siblings who are twins are 69.
Oh.
So my older sister pretty much raised me, and I think she still thinks that I'm her son rather than her brother.
And you did. You mentioned that your older siblings protected you and you have found time to do reading. How did that factor when you moved to Lake Charles and started high school?
I'm sorry, how did that what?
How did that factor into your life when you moved to Lake Charles and started high school?
My older brothers and sisters, with the exception of two, did not have the opportunity to finish high school. They did not want me to live that life. And so they knew that reading and education were probably the roads to success and the roads out of Mallet, the roads out of that hamlet. And so I was well-read, quite frankly, at the time. So when we moved to Lake Charles, the folks in Lake Charles referred to us as from down east, which is east of Lake Charles. And we spoke with a Creole French accent. And so they associated that with a lack of sophistication. They associated that with being less than intelligent. And so they were very surprised that I quickly went from being that guy from down east to the head of my class. I played clarinet while in the small hamlet from sixth grade through eighth grade. So when I entered the high school in the larger city, I was well versed in music. So I quickly went from being the fourth seat on the band to the first chair in the clarinet section and the saxophone section.
And was the band the only club you were involved in high school?
No, I was into everything. The French club, the band, the National Honor Society. I played intramural basketball. I was part of the Key Club. I was president of my class.
Yeah, you did a lot.
Those types of things. Yeah. Yeah, so I quickly rose to leadership positions during my tenure at Washington High School, Janelle, which is where I went. That school no longer exists. It was merged with the predominantly white school and is now Washington Marion High School.
Okay. You mentioned that your older siblings wanted you to finish high school because that wasn't an opportunity they get. So my question is, after finishing high school, what was your motivation to continue on into higher education?
Well, I knew I didn't want to work on a farm. I knew I did not want to work in the industrial complexes in Lake Charles. I knew I did not want to be a laborer. And so from an early age, I always wondered, what do I want to be when I grow up? Do I want to be a priest? And I thought about going to the seminary. Do I want to be an actor? Do I want to be an engineer? Do I want to be a chemist? Do I want to be a lawyer? I did not know. But those things were constantly on my mind. And I knew that the only way to get out of that environment was to be educated. And so that was my motivation. I knew that I wanted to make money. I knew that I wanted to contribute to society. Because I saw what others had become when they were not educated.
And did your other siblings who went to high school also followed and went to higher education?
No, only a brother before me decided to go to and complete college. So we were two of 11 who actually completed college.
And do your siblings still reside on your father's land?
No, I have four siblings who died. They're all older than me. They're all died of cancer. Fortunately, I don't smoke, so I don't have that much of a worry. I have a brother who lives in Spring, Texas, a sister who lives in Houston, Texas, and three sisters and a brother who live in Lake Charles, where I live. And my parents are deceased.
Yes. Speaking of your parents, you mentioned your father, but not your mom. What did your mom do?
My mother was a homemaker, and she worked on the farm with my siblings and with my father, When we moved to Lake Charles, she was not able to work because she suffered a debilitating stroke. So she was a homemaker when we lived in Lake Charles. And she died when I was a junior at Dartmouth.
And my condolences. Speaking of Dartmouth, when did you first hear of Dartmouth?
Oh, it was my senior year of high school. I had never heard of Dartmouth before. And my high school counselor enrolled me in a program called Cooperative Program for Educational Opportunity, which was at that time headquartered at Yale. And so the counselor's office had me take a series of tests, achievement tests. And apparently I did well on those tests. And they were sent to the office at Yale, the Cooperative Program for Educational Opportunity, which set my test scores to various colleges and universities across the country. And so I received letters from probably 200 colleges and universities asking for my application, one of which was Dartmouth. So I applied to Dartmouth and got accepted and waited until the last day to really accept the offer. It was between Dartmouth and Xavier University in New Orleans, where many of my friends were going.
Okay.
And so I heard of Dartmouth through the Cooperative Program for Educational Opportunity.
What made you decide to choose Dartmouth instead of Xavier?
It was the money. I had a full ride, a full scholarship, along with a small loan and a work study offer. And it was an Ivy League school. While Xavier is a good school, my wife went to Xavier. I have no regrets in attending. So it was really a matter of the status of the academic environment and the financial assistance that was offered.
And what clubs were you involved in while you was at Dartmouth?
The Afro-American Society, Delta Kappa Epsilon Fraternity for 1 year, Green Key, Cask and Goblet, and the Tucker Foundation.
And you said you were in Delta Kappa Fraternity for 1 year. Did you de-pledge?
Did I do it?
Did you de-pledge or did you join your senior year before you graduated?
Oh, no. This was my first year.
Okay.
Yeah. And after the first year, I decided that that was not for me. Fraternity life was not for me. And so I disengaged myself from the fraternity.
And what was your role in the Afro Society? Did you have exec position or were you just a member?
I was a member and I participated in all of their activities, including the protests that existed on campus.
Okay. And how did you being involved in the Afro Society influence your time at Dartmouth?
Well, it allowed me a sense of solidarity, a sense of being, a sense of brotherhood, a sense of belonging. In the fall of 1967, there were approximately 825 students entering that first year in the class of 1971. And there were only 16 Black students in that class, and 32 as an aggregate number for the entire school. And so you have to understand, I'm coming from South Louisiana. I'm almost in the Gulf of Mexico. You can't get any farther south than that. And so this was my first interaction with white students because I went to a segregated high school. And so Dartmouth was a very strange animal to be, academically and both culturally. And so the Afro-American Society provided a shield for me, a sense of protection for me, a sense of comfort.
Okay. You mentioned that you were involved in the protest. Can you describe what that was like?
Yeah, of course. You know, at that time, 1967 through 1971, the Vietnam War was a big topic of discussion. The Black Consciousness Movement, the Black Power Movement, was at its height then. Campus protests, the Student for Democratic Society, was on most campuses and was decrying the lack of moral commitment that the U.S. had, particularly with respect to a war engagement, and particularly with respect to, we did not call it inclusion then, but particularly with respect to affirmative action. And so we had speakers such as William Shockley. I think he's a physicist by training, but he also was very much engaged in spreading the idea that Blacks were intellectually familiar. I mean, inferior. That is, they were born that way, and that white society was the preferred society, and that Black advancement was an illusion because of the intellectual inferiority of Black society. And so he came to speak on campus, and we did not allow him to speak on campus. There's an old picture of many Black students, along with sympathetic white students. And I think one of my classmates showed me that I was in one of those pictures. We didn't have cell cameras then. We didn't have digital cameras. So of course I didn't take the pictures. I'm not sure who did. Wally Ford, class of 1970, organized a protest on the middle of the campus green to protest against the Vietnam War and against apartheid in South Africa. So those were some of the things that I engaged in as protest matters. There were several students who took over the administration building. I think they belonged to the Students for a Democratic Society. While I was sympathetic with them, I did not join them.
And why didn't you join them?
I did not think that would be that would do anything really to foster, you know, my growth as a person, or foster my growth as a person. Then the students who occupied the building, while we were sympathetic to them, had not really contributed anything for the advancement of Black students on campus. So why should I join them? I mean, it was expedient for them to ask us to join us at that time, but I was not going to risk expulsion for that. I mean, my father was not an officer of General Motors. He was not a CEO of a major Fortune 500 company. And so I'm not wasn't about to risk my future, particularly my educational future, on that sort of thing, particularly when I did not see much coming out of that.
That's understandable. You mentioned
I learned how to play poker in the lobby of Hinman Hall from some of my classmates who were not that interested in going to class because they had a fallback position. If they didn't make it in college, or even if they made it with minimal grades, they knew that they had a future in the business world. I didn't have that advantage. So I didn't take that chance, but they played poker a lot. So I observed them. I learned how to play poker. And to this day, I still play poker. I was not going to sacrifice going to classes just for the purposes for the hell of playing poker.
That's true. You mentioned the Vietnam War. Can you speak about how drafting was for you? Like, how did it affect you or not?
How what affected me?
The Vietnam draft.
I had decided I'm not going to Vietnam, not because I was afraid of being shot at, not because I was afraid of protecting my country. I just didn't believe in it from a political or moral standpoint. I was going to go to Canada instead, and I was very serious about that. Fortunately, one of my classmates' father was a military examiner in New York City. So I graduated on June 13, 1971, and I was supposed to report to the draft that following Friday. I was examined. I remember that vividly in New York City by Dr. Renatus Hartogs, who issued a medical report saying that I was not fit for military service. I think at that time it was labeled like 4F because I had an ankle injury. while playing intramural athletics at Dartmouth. And I had a brother who had a developmentally deficient condition. At that time, it was called retarded. Now it's called developmentally disabled. So on the basis of, I assume, that report, I was given, I was reclassified to Fort App, and I was not, I did not join the military service. So I was able to stay in the United States. I worked for 1 year with the Dean of Students at Dartmouth before deciding what I wanted to do. I did not know whether or not I wanted to go to business school or law school. It was definitely not medical school. And so I decided after that 1 year, that gap year, I decided that law school would be my best path to assist me doing what I wanted to do. And that is to come back to assist my community in social and political activities, to practice law, to use law as a means of changing society. And we all thought when we finished that we would come back to our communities and we would have a revolution. I mean, we would revolutionize the country. That didn't quite happen. We made a few changes, but we certainly did not accomplish our goal of revolutionizing our communities and our country.
You mentioned that you played intramural athletics. What sports did you play?
Well, in high school, I played basketball. And in college, I played softball. I mean, yeah, softball and basketball.
Okay. Were those the varsity team or like a club sport?
And the club sport. No, I was not good enough to make a varsity team, nor did I want to. I wanted to commit myself to academics.
So going back to education, I know, like, how did the start or like the creation of the African and African-American department impact your Dartmouth experience?
It made me want to do good, but it also taught me that in order to do good, you must do well. If you're suffering and you cannot pay the rent, pay the mortgage, pay your employees, you will not have the time nor the desire, nor the ability or the capacity to effect change. It taught me the value of history. It taught me the value of my person. It taught me the value of my race. And it taught me that, you know, we're all in this together regardless of our various hues. We have various cultures and subcultures within the Black community. You know, we have folks who are dark-skinned, as you are. We have folks who are light-skinned, as I am. But that should not create divisions within that community. And so it certainly taught me that. It taught me the value of community, taught me the value of solidarity, and it taught me the value of appreciating ourselves. And it exposed me to various writers that I was not exposed to in high school. The William Douglases of the Frederick Douglases of the world, the Mary Barakas of the world, the Angela Davises of the world, James Baldwin, Ralph Ellison, those sorts of unique and change agents in our society.
So speaking of your value of race and not being divided, do you remember where you were when Martin Luther King was assassinated?
I do remember that very vividly. I was studying in my dorm room, April 4th. It was the spring semester of my first year. And I remember being very angry at my white suite mates who did not consider that very significant because it did not impact them that much, you know, even though he was a revolutionary figure. And as soon as moments after he was assassinated, we all gathered. Woody Lee, who is a Yale professor at Yale Medical School now, was the president of the Afro-American Society. And we all gathered at Rollins Chapel or the lobby, I don't quite recall the lobby, one of the dorms, to discuss, well, what does that mean to us? How do we celebrate his legacy on campus within the next few days? How do we move forward in explaining to our white classmates what this means to America and what this means to me personally? So yeah, I remember that very, very vividly.
And what's the name of the dorm that you resided in?
My first year was Hinman. My second year was Cohen. And my third and fourth years were at 209 Ripley Hall. And my classmate was Frank Watkins from Brooklyn, New York Boys High. And so our dorm room, 209 Ripley, we had a suite really, was the stopping point where many of the Black students gathered just before going to the football game.
I see. And you mentioned that you guys gathered to educate your white peers and why Martin Luther King's assassination was so significant. Were you able to achieve that goal?
I think so. I mean, to the extent that we could, we certainly could not educate the whole college campus, but we were able to educate those who were around us. And to give you a couple of examples, I had a classmate from, I think, Boise, Idaho, who in his entire life had never met a Black person. The only Black person he had seen was the folks on the Bill Cosby show. True. And he didn't think that I was Black because of my the fairness of my skin. And so he was very curious. He was very ignorant, not in a nefarious way. He was just naive. And so I had to explain to him the uniqueness of Black society, the various subcultures of Black society. And to my my suite mates, you know, we held meetings, and quite frankly, to their advantage, they were curious about why does this all matter to me or to us. And I remember I had to explain to one of my classmates, my suite mates from Pelham, New York. We had to write a paper, I think, on Paradise Lost. And the paper was on my desk. And he happened to stumble into my room and he read the paper. And he called me Baudu. My name is Thibodeau, but he called me Baudu. He said, "This is pretty good." And so I wondered, why do you think this is, are you surprised that this is pretty good? You know, I guess he thought this is a Black guy from the deep South. And, he comes from Hicksville and he doesn't know what this is all about. And so I had to explain to him that he would not say that to a white student. Why is he saying that to me? Does he think I don't belong there? So I had to have long conversations with him explaining certain stereotypes that had to be gotten rid of. You know, you bring your baggage to the plate. And that was part of his baggage, the stereotypical image, and all those things that come with that stereotypical image. You know, all those negative images that one can conjure. And before too long, he became one of my best friends. But you have to confront that. You've got to confront that. And I learned how to, because of the Black Studies program, because of the Afro-American Society, it made me confront those realities. It made me face those realities, made me recognize those realities. And I use that today. I don't let people get away with things. Not because I was a former judge, but I'm going to challenge you. I'm going to challenge you. And in challenging people, Janelle, you're performing a function. You are actually educating them for free. No tuition free.
So you mentioned that everyone had bring their baggage to the plate. Like, while you were educating him, did you realize that any baggage that you had on your plate in that time?
That I had what?
Any baggage that you had on your plate during that time?
Yeah, of course. Everybody has biases, some subconscious and some unconscious biases that you've got to to deal with. I went on campus believing what I had been told all of my life, that, you know, a kid from South Louisiana, particularly if you're Black, could not succeed as well as others. I certainly overcame that. I remember making the dean's list my first trimester. And of course, all of the Black students, the 16, I was very proud of of that. I came to campus not knowing a hell of a lot about white society. I learned about white society. I thought that all white people were racist and that they really didn't care about social justice. They only cared about advancing themselves. And I had read, you know, more than Dr. King's book, Letters from a Birmingham Jail, where he said that it really, it's our enemy is not those like the KKK who will take affirmative negative actions against us. It's those liberals who refuse to speak out and who let things happen and are not as vigilant in their deeds as they are in their words. So yeah, I learned that. But I learned, just as in the biases that we have, you have to learn how to overcome that sort of thing. You recognize that you have them. You have to recognize them first, whether they're implicit or explicit. And once you recognize that, then you can move forward. It's no different than being a judge. You bring your baggage to the table as a judge. You recognize that, and you try to overcome that in your rulings. So yeah, Dartmouth played a very essential part in assisting me with that sort of stuff. That, you know, that you're not perfect, that you have baggage that you have to dispel and get rid of, or at least recognize. So it was not only a good academic experience, a good and difficult academic experience, it was a good cultural experience. And it made me mature, much more mature as an individual. I thought that when I finished law school at age 24, 25, I thought I could conquer the world. I thought I was ready to leave Dartmouth after my third year. I asked, what else is there to learn? And my roommate kids me about that to this day.
What's the name of your roommate?
I'm sorry.
What was the name of your roommate?
Frank Watkins. He's a Dr. Watkins now. He's an orthopedist who practiced in New York. He lived in Westchester County for a long time, and he moved a couple of years ago to Stamford, Connecticut. But yeah, that's my roommate, Frank. We talk all the time. You develop lasting friendships. And you probably already know that, Janelle. You develop, most of your lasting friendships are developed in college as opposed to elementary school, as opposed to your high school friends. And so we keep up with each other. Just about every member of my class who are still alive keep up with each other, because we remember that closeness that we had during our 4 years at Dartmouth. And we remember that closeness that we had our first year at Dartmouth.
Okay. How was your transition from high school that was segregated to being at Dartmouth? How was that like?
It wasn't puzzling. It was challenging. Number one, I had not been in that environment before, that cultural environment. I had not been in that racial environment. And I had not been in that academic environment, so it was intimidating. Imagine, for one who has gone to a private prep school, it can be intimidating. So one who's come from a public segregated high school in the Deep South, that's also very intimidating. So how did I deal with that intimidation? By sinking myself into my studies and by developing lasting friendships with supportive classmates, particularly supportive Black classmates. You know, you get on campus and you say, what the hell did I get into? What did I get into? And can I deal with that? And there were some doubts that first year. You know, every person goes through that. You're homesick. You want to you want to get closer to home, you want to get closer to your friends and your families. And then you decide, you know, it's very good to be outside of that environment because you get the opportunity to be much more expansive from a human standpoint than you would be if you were enveloped within the cocoon of your friends.
So given this and all the growth that you did from your various programs and being involved with more Black students, how did you connect or did you connect with any of your white peers?
In Dartmouth?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, sure. I keep up with them today. During our virtual 50th reunion, I was on a panel and several of us reconnected then. So it wasn't really a hostile environment, Janelle. It was more of an environment of ignorance. It's more of an environment of a lack of exposure, on behalf of myself, lack of exposure and naivete on behalf of my white schoolmates and classmates. Yeah, so I developed and still do have a bond with many of my white classmates, and they realized themselves that they had to overcome those biases that they brought with them to college campus. Life is much different if you're living in Shaker Heights than if you're living in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Life is much different if you're living in Westchester County than if you're living in Jamaica. Okay, so yeah, we had a good time overcoming those things. And sometimes sometimes we disagreed. You know, so what? At least I'm gonna learn from you. It was an educational experience for me from that standpoint. I think I learned just as much outside of the classroom as I did inside of the classroom, but I did not take any chances. I think I got my work done because, as I said, my father wasn't the CEO of General Motors. and ultimately, because they thought of the Black students as something exotic, something fanciful, they wanted to know as much about us as we wanted to know about them. And I remember many of them hung out with us. They hung out with us because of the experience, because of the learning experience, and because of the solidarity among us. We were only 32 of us on campus. They enjoyed that, and I think they were envious of that fellowship and that solidarity. So they said, "Hey, I want to be part of this too. Can I join you?"
Speaking of solidarity, what was it like when women's rights was becoming more popular and Dartmouth was leaning towards co-education? What was the environment on Dartmouth campus like?
Like when? What do you mean?
Like 1971, right when there was more women coming on campus, but Dartmouth wasn't co-education yet. Right. Can you speak more towards that activism, that accord there for women to be on campus?
Yeah, I remember Meryl Streep we were sitting in the student center, and Meryl Streep would pass by, and she was going to the drama department, and because we were not co-ed, we thought that was strange and unusual to be in that kind of environment. I went to a co-ed high school, and so why can't we have a co-ed college? And I thought, and many other students thought, that we were losing something because of that lack of inclusiveness. We were losing something because of what is called normalcy. And I didn't term that phrase. What's the screenwriter's name who graduated from Dartmouth? She was like the Thursday Night Queen. She's a screenwriter. She's big in Hollywood. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Yeah, because of that lack of normal. That's not normal. That wasn't normal. And so we were big supporters of co-education, not just because of the social enhancement. Oh, we got somebody to date. We don't have to go to Smith or Mount Holyoke or Wellesley, all that sort of thing. We had, you know, folks here on campus. So we were selfish because we wanted y'all on campus. But we were also supportive of the idea that we are missing something. That, I mean, society, when we finish in, you know, in 1971, society, we won't face that kind of society where women are restricted to their side of the table and we're restricted to ours. And so we were big supporters of co-education. And I think it added a lot to the campus. I mean, just think right now, we have more women in law school than we have males. And so there's going to be a sea change, and there is a sea change now because of the number of women who are now joining law firms and who are becoming partners at major law firms and who are becoming litigators at major law firms. And, you know, I'm not sure that would have happened if the big time institutions and the prestigious institutions such as Dartmouth would not have allowed that to happen, to open their doors and to welcome that segment of society. And so we learned to not look upon women as objects, but as equals.
Interesting. You mentioned Smith and Simmons and how the men back then would go to those schools and Redcliffe colleges. Mm-hmm. How was it like dating as a Black man on campus?
On Dartmouth's campus?
Yes.
I became comfortable after a while, but I still felt that estrangement. This is not what I'm used to. You know, I'm not used to going eating with white folks at the cafeteria. The only white people I saw were those folks who came to collect rent in my neighborhood. Fortunately, we owned our home. My dad was able to buy his home. And so it was very uncomfortable at first. And you tried to become involved in campus community. Not when I say you, I'm talking about one generally decided to, let's become involved with athletics, let's become involved with drama, let's become involved in recruiting more Black students so that life could be more comfortable. And that was a major effort on the part of the Afro-American Society. You know, we convinced the school administration that, hey, won't you send us on the road to recruit other Black students in various parts of the country? Won't you send us to college campuses in the South, to Tupelo, to Tuskegee, to Xavier, to Dillard, to recruit particularly Black women to come on campus? Why? Because we thought that they should be having, that's the same opportunity we were having. And we thought that by doing that, by making it more of a multicultural society, that everybody would be able to benefit. So it was simply not selfish motives, it was academic and intellectual motives as well. Being at Dartmouth made me a lawyer. I was interested in chemistry. I was going to be this big researcher, this big chemist. It's not fun walking from Hinman on the river across campus to in 3 feet of snow to a lab. I said, this is not for me. You know, I'm going to do something. I'm going to be a teacher, a lawyer, or a businessman, but I'm not going to continue like this. So yeah, I became a lawyer because of the snow.
You mentioned that you were activism for more Black students on Dartmouth campus. You were involved in the Black Student Application and Encouragement Committee.
Which committee?
The Black Student Application Encouragement Committee.
It wasn't called that at the time, Janelle. It was simply called the Afro-American Society. And we didn't have any committees. We just volunteered to assist in increasing the number of Black applicants and increasing the number of successful Black applicants. So it went from 32 in 1967 and 68 to almost 200 2 years later. And that was a huge transformation from what we knew as incoming freshmen. And hell, I mean, many of them 2 years later, 2 or 3 years later, I mean, it was, we had such a population that many of them I didn't know. You tend to travel within your circles. Yeah. So I can imagine what it is now. It's a huge difference. And in fact, we did not have enough students to have fraternities or sororities. So those of us in those years who are now members of the Alphas, the Kappas, the Sigmas, we joined the graduate chapters. I mean, I didn't join. I haven't joined yet, and I'm not going to join. But for those of us in my era who are members of a Greek organization, it's because they joined the graduate chapters. We didn't have that on campus.
Do you feel that the lack of Black Greek life on Dartmouth campus contributed to the environment that was there? Or would you wish those fraternities and sororities came about a little earlier while there's only 16 of you back then?
Not really. You know, I tend, but this is a personal view, I tend to think of fraternities and sororities as forced friendships. And so, no, I'm glad that we didn't have them, quite frankly, because, you know, we did not, that did not create that sort of competitiveness among us with such small numbers. Why do you need to compete? You need to join, not compete. You need to be supportive of each other, not antagonistic because of some organization. So no, I don't regret that at all.
Okay.
But by the same token, I don't regret folks joining those organizations. Yeah. As long as they don't live within those organizations completely, yeah.
You mentioned that you dropped chemistry because of the snow. So what did you end up majoring in?
Government. Ended up majoring in government, but you know, I involved myself in a lot of educational initiatives through the Tucker Foundation. For example, in the winter of 1969, I taught elementary school in Jersey City, New Jersey, as part of a Tucker Foundation initiative. And Woody Lee, who was in the class of 1968 or 69, was the director of that program in Jersey City. So we taught elementary school in Jersey City, I think at PS 29, which was at that time, I think, the largest elementary school in the country. And we also were involved with the Black Panthers in their breakfast program and in their tutorial programs in the afternoon. In my senior year, the winter of 1971, I taught high school in Richmond, California, at John F. Kennedy High School. I taught math, I taught English, and I taught, at that time it was not African-American, it was Black history. I still prefer the term Black history to African-American. So I became involved in education at an early time in my adult life, you know, as a student at Dartmouth. It made me much more involved in becoming much more of a political and social activist than I would not have been otherwise. And that's one of the reasons I've started 3 charter schools here in my hometown of Lake Charles, Louisiana.
Quick question. Mm-hmm. You said you prefer Black history than compared to African-American. Why is that?
I think the term African-American is too limited. And if you're Black, you're much more of a part of the diaspora, which, you know, which takes in Latin America, that takes in the Caribbean, it takes in the continent of Africa and everywhere where there are Black people. I mean, I don't object to the term African American. I just prefer to use the term Black because it's more expansive and it's more inclusive, I think.
That's true. How was your...
And it expanded from Afro-American to African-American. Yeah.
How was your experience in the Tucker Foundation, given the political climate at Dartmouth at the time?
That was great. I'm glad I was involved. A lot of your education, Janelle, comes from the exterior, not the interior. And I found out that, hell, this is what the real world is. And these are some of the real world problems. And these are some of the pragmatic ways that you can approach those problems. You really don't have a full appreciation of those problems and the implementation of programs to address those problems until you're away from your little cocoon. You know, you're growing up. You told me you grew up. Where are you from, Janelle?
Jamaica.
You're from Jamaica. Yeah. Not just you, but one generally tends to work within a small environment. If you're in New York City, you're from BAM, Brooklyn, how often do you go into Manhattan? Okay, you know your environment and you work within that small environment. And so by working with the Tucker Foundation, it exposed me to that larger environment, not just that intellectually insular Hanover environment. And during my sophomore year, I went with, I forget the name of the professor, I studied for 3 months in Sierra Leone, West Africa. And that exposed me to a whole new different world. And so we had all those opportunities, all those advantages that really just expanded one as a person and gave one a much broader knowledge of what the world was all about. At the same time, we were insulated in Hanover. Oh my God, where is this? We're lost. We were several hours from New York, we were an hour and a half from Boston. So it felt like we were just divorced from everything else that was happening in the outside world. So those programs that were Tucker Foundation sponsored were really, really, really helpful in overcoming that. I can recall my first year in December of 1967, I left Hanover and caught a plane for the first time in my life in Boston, Massachusetts. When I got to Massachusetts, I said, wow, we're civilization again. Because you tend to be, as I said, it's not the real world in Hanover, New Hampshire. It's good for intellectual development. It's good for exposure to other students and other cultures, but that's not the real world. That's not the real world. But that's a disadvantage. The advantage was we're shielded from all this stuff, this negative stuff that's going on in other areas, particularly urban areas. We're shielded from incivility. You know, we're shielded from poverty. We are somewhat shielded. We are shielded from violent activities in both the urban and rural areas. We're our own little world. We're just comfortable, but it's not real.
So how did this shielding in this insular, isolated New Hampshire have on Dartmouth students who weren't or were experiencing these real world problems?
Who were not experienced?
Who were experiencing the real world problems?
Oh my God, it was a shock. It was a shock just as it was to me. You know, I grew up in a relative civil society. It was mostly a Black society. But we also had many students later on who came from large urban areas. You know, the Clevelands, the Boston, the New York cities, the Houston, Texas, the Miamis of the world, that sort of thing. And so some of them were exposed to that. This was not something that was not unusual to them. And at that time, we had a program that engaged and enrolled students from Chicago, gang members. And I don't recall the name of the program, but there were like 15 or 20 gang members who came to Dartmouth under a special program I think initiated by the Tucker Foundation. And a couple of years ago in the Dartmouth Alumni Magazine, there was a story on them. And I still keep up with several of them. In fact, one just texted, friended me on Facebook yesterday, Percy Wiggins. I remember Percy. And they were older students. They were much more into real world experiences, sometimes violent experiences. Now, Henry Crumpton, I remember him. I spoke with him several years ago, and we keep up by Facebook. To them, it was a relief from the daily activities that they were accustomed to. And many of them were very successful in navigating the Dartmouth environment, the Dartmouth academic environment. Yeah, so it wasn't, to them, it was no big deal. I know some of those real world problems. I didn't want to experience those kinds of problems and those kinds of issues in that kind of environment. But I think Dartmouth equipped me. You find out later on that this was a good experience. You find out later on that it gave you the tools, okay, to really implement concrete programs that would benefit your local community and benefit the entire larger community. And it gave you the opportunity to make, you know, lasting relationships and to meet and develop relationships, business relationships, academic relationships that lasted forever. You could pick up the phone and, you know, you needed somebody in New York City. I know somebody in New York City. Or if you, for instance, one of my law clerks, after she finished her tenure with me at the court, was moving to Dallas, Texas, and needed a job. So I looked up lawyers in the Dallas, Texas areas who were Dartmouth grads. Didn't know me, I didn't know them. I said, hey, Janelle is looking for employment in the Dallas area. Can you help her? And they did. But it's the value of those relationships, the value of connections, I call it connectivity, lasts forever.
Speaking of academic relationships, were there any professors at Dartmouth that had an impact on you?
Yeah, Frank Smallwood, government professor. Two things. I was taking a government course from Professor Smallwood. My mother died, like in November, just before the finals. And, that's very emotionally disturbing. And so because of that emotional state, I couldn't prepare for my finals. So I went to him and said, look, you know, my mother just died. So I better go home. And he said, don't worry about it, Gene, just take your exams after you get back from the holidays. Don't even worry about coming back to campus. So that taught me about humanness and the gift of humanity, that there are people who really are concerned about you, not just as a student, but as a person. And so that translated into me being concerned about other folks, not just for professional reasons, but for personal reasons as well. And my French teacher, I came in with a credit in French 1. And so I started French 2, and I don't know her name. She was a French professor of German origins. I don't remember her name. But she said, look, and you know, I was very nervous about making it academically. And so she made me feel very comfortable. Yep, under those conditions.
That's good.
And then another professor in the English department, he didn't have an impact on me, but he made me realize that sometimes professors didn't think that we were not meritorious enough to be there. And I recall him telling one of my Black classmates that he didn't think he should be at Dartmouth. And so that made me work, he did. And that made me work even harder. And so it made me realize there's some folks on this campus who don't think we should be here. And this was before, And this was before affirmative action. I think affirmative action became really big in 1969 when Nixon was president, believe it or not, and Dr. Sullivan in Philadelphia, Reverend Sullivan, instituted the Sullivan Plan. You know, and so even though we were not affirmative action kids, affirmative action students still thought of us as that. And so it was I think some of them were really conscious and trying to make you feel that, hey, this is, you know, you can't stand these academic rigors. And so it made you more vigilant in showing them otherwise.
How was the unity between Blacks who were a part of the Vice Lords, the gang, versus Blacks who were affluent, those who weren't? How would you describe the interconnectedness of the Black community?
The interconnectedness of the Black community on campus?
Yes, but among like just the Black community, like those who had money, those who didn't, those who were part of the Vice Lords, those who weren't.
Yeah, there wasn't really a disconnect. There really wasn't a disconnect. We had six, we had, before the special program, which allowed the folks from Chicago to be on campus, came like 2 years. I think it's in this fall of 1969. But as part of my class, we had several of my classmates from well-to-do backgrounds. And we discussed that. Now, one of my classmates' father had several funeral homes in Harlem, and he was, you know, pretty well-heeled. Some were middle class. Some, like myself, were not. The tuition at time, well, the tuition plus room and board and other related expenses were more than my father made in the entire year. So I know I was not middle class or upper middle class, but we didn't see that as any issue among ourselves at all. It wasn't like I am Janelle Mathias and I come from a well-heeled background and you do not. And so I'm not going to be deferential to you, but instead, you know, I'm going to turn my nose up at you. It wasn't that way at all. Hell, it couldn't be that way because you couldn't survive in that kind of environment. Then you have to remember, this is 1967. You couldn't, then through 1971, you couldn't survive in an environment if you were going to segregate yourselves in that type of caste society. You just couldn't. And we wouldn't let you. If you did that, don't worry, we would tell you and we would remind you. Or we would say, look, yeah, I'm from the South, I'm a segregated school, but I got better grades than you. So no, we did. That wasn't a problem at all. That was not a barrier. It was not a hurdle at all. It made us realize, you know, we're all in this together.
Besides your dorm,
and I'm not sure, and I don't know that, but I get the impression that you don't have that. That's kind of closeness. That kind of unity doesn't exist today on the campus. Kind of no, it doesn't. It doesn't. You know, that's almost, I'm told, it's almost a class society division. You belong here and I belong there. And I guess that's, you know, the earth spins forward and you've got to spin forward with it. And so many of these students are, what are they called? Legacy. Their fathers went and their mothers went to Dartmouth, their grandmothers and grandparents went to Dartmouth. And I'm talking about Black students. That's how far we've come. Yeah. And so I think there's a certain, I think without knowing, there's a certain degree of division now that did not exist, would not exist when I was a student there.
Why would you think that division is here now? versus it wouldn't have been happened there? Do you think it's just due to the lack of numbers in the Black community?
I think if there is a division, it's because there is a larger degree of interest, diverse interest among members of the Black student population than there was when I was there. You've got, and I think there's a sense sometimes that I made this on my own, and I'm not here because of the struggles of my predecessors. You know, we stand on the shoulder of giants, and sometimes a midget who stands on the shoulder of a giant is supposed to see farther than that giant. So you're supposed to go one step farther than I did. And we've got students there whose parents and grandparents have been very successful. And I think that perhaps rather than creating a solidarity, that has created a division. And it's an artificial division. And they're going to learn that once they graduate. It's going to hit them right in the face. I'm telling you. I'm telling you. So I'm happy that they're very successful. I'm happy that their parents and grandparents are successful. But they have to understand that there was, you simply didn't do that overnight. I mean, I always, when I talk to students today, I always, you know, they're interested in sports. So I tell them, you know, LeBron James didn't jump out of his mama's womb dribbling a basketball. You know, you can't have the crops without plowing up the ground. Something had to have happened to make, to put you in the position you are today. You know, that the position where, which allowed you to be where you are. Because your parents were successful. Your parents, your grandparents were successful. You didn't make this on your own. And if you believe that, you're in for a big disappointment later on in life.
Besides your dorm, where else did you and your Black friends, or just Black students in general, hang out on campus?
You hung out at the Afro-American Society's building, Cutler, at the Elhaj Malik Al-Shabazz building. I'm not sure if it's still named that, but that's where we hung out. Mm-hmm. There, or in the football stands on Saturday afternoons, or in the student center. Those were the three primary places.
It's still
in somebody's dorm room. Yeah. Depends on who had the most jazz records and who was closest to the gymnasium, or who was closest to the stadium.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of jazz,
yes.
How would you describe the effect of the 1970s on music? Or what effect did music have on the 1970s?
You had people like the impressions, people get ready, Nina Simone, to be young, gifted, and Black. Those kinds of artists, Aretha Franklin, Respect. Those, James Brown, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, you know. It gave us a sense of identity and a sense of consciousness. I remember my roommate, he used to have these big speakers, and he put them in the window of our dorm on Saturday afternoon, just before the football game, because we had several of our schoolmates on the football team, and we went to cheer them on. And so unlike the huge tailgate party you see on ESPN on Saturday, we had, you know, smaller tailgate parties. You know, we had limousines where people for the tailgaters, and Frank would put these big speakers in our window at the dorm. We were on the second floor, and blast out the Impressions, blast out James Brown, blast out the Temptations and the Miracles. And so, yeah, and we call those revolution songs, you know, and it kind of shaped our aspirations and it kind of shaped our desire to be like them, but in a different arena. I mean, I can't sing. I played the clarinet and saxophone, but you know, I couldn't have that exposure that music had at that time. So it invigorated us to go out and do those revolutionary things that they were talking about. And at the same time, it gave us, because we were in this society, it gave us a greater appreciation of Black music. We had two professors from Yale who were visiting professors, Willie Ruff and Dwight Mitchell, who taught a course on jazz appreciation. And that was very popular among all students, not just Black students. But our treat was that Dizzy Gillespie was a guest lecturer for 2 weeks. Dizzy wore two leather outfits, one brown and one black. He alternated. One class, he had a black leather suit. The next class, he had a brown leather suit. And so it gave us an appreciation of that kind of music, music that many of us had not been exposed to before. And so that was the music of the time. It was music of liberation.
How would you describe the music of this generation?
It's not music, it's noise. Music, okay. There's noise. I mean, as far as I'm concerned. Let me, in 1965, the Temptations came out with a song that was written by Smokey Robinson called My Girl. Talking about my girl, my girl. Everybody sings that. All generations sing that. All races sing that. I've got sunshine on a cloudy day. Our high school band played that. And so it's still very popular today. You name me one rap song that's going to be popular 55, 60 years from now. Not one. And you know that. I know you probably like it. Hip hop is fine, rap is not. So I'm not sure if that, how impactful that music is going to be today. It's more enjoyable to your generation than it is to mine. But the music of my generation had an impact. I don't think this music will have an impact. I don't think that in the history of music or in music annals that you're going to hear something about Snoop Doggy Dogg, something like that. No, I'm telling you, you know, or about Mr. Thug or something, you know. It's, I may be wrong, I may be devaluing that music, but I don't see a whole bunch of value in that. But I didn't grow up in that kind of generation. I know I didn't grow up with iPads and computers and Zoom. You know, and so it's hard to adapt to that. You have to, because you're enveloped by it. You have to do it. You can't escape it. It's all around you. You know, but I don't think that music will be impactful as the music that I grew up with. And I think music historians will tell you that. You know, like Whitmore Salas, who runs the jazz at Lincoln Center in New York, and Dizzy's Coca-Cola Club, that kind of music will last forever. John Coltrane will last forever. Miles Davis will last forever. Jimmy Smith will last forever. Lester Young, Ella Fitzgerald, those folks will last forever. Those artists today will not last forever. Although you understand the music, you don't really, and you appreciate it, you're certainly not attracted to it. Yeah. I bet you disagree.
How would you describe that shift from music of your day to the noise of my day?
Well, it's noisy music. It's a, I think it's just a lack of musical history. I really, really do. You know, I like it's easy listening jazz. But Wynton Marsalis and those folks who play that, you know, the Kenny G's of the world, they're very technically educated in music. They just didn't pick up an instrument and started playing. They know music. They know how to compose music, know how to write music, but for commercial purposes, okay, you can't play the classical jazz of Mingus, of Davis, and of those people, because you're not going to make any money. And so the Kenny G's of the world will play what folks will respond to and what audiences will respond to. Otherwise, you'll be playing to an empty room and you'll be broke. Yeah, so I understand that. So it's mostly, as opposed to music, just for the sake of musical appreciation, it's become more monetized. It's become more commercialized. And I understand, you know, that difference. I mean, how many kids will listen to those musicians that I've just named? Not many. Not many.
How would you describe?
Listen to Drake and Lil Wayne and those kinds of artists. Aretha Franklin would last forever.
She sure will. She will last forever. Mm-hmm. But how would you describe your first day on campus?
My first date?
Your first day. How would you describe your first day on campus?
Wow, what is this? My sister, my brother-in-law was a military guy at Fort Dix, New Jersey. So I stopped there on the way here. And all my belongings were in a trunk. The trunk was lost en route from Louisiana to New Jersey. So my sister and I had to go shopping. I had nothing except the clothes on my back. And so, you know, we did our shopping. We got enough clothes for me to last, for a year on campus. So they dropped me off like at 9 o'clock at night. It was dark. I didn't know anything. Found my room, went into my room. And the next day was, the first person I met was Peter Lance from Harlem, New York. Peter was I saw him in a black suit, very sophisticated. How are you? I'm fine, man. Where you from? We told ourselves where we were from. And, you know, Peter went on to Berkeley Law School and then drowned while in law school. But he was the first gentleman, first person, black or white, that I met on campus. And it was fortuitous and fateful because, oh my God, okay, I have some company. I have some company now. And, but I was, I was lost. I felt like paradise lost. Where I am? Where am I? You know, there are these mountains and all these colorful trees. And so it was frightening. It was intimidating. And it was like you're out, a ship sailing at sea without any direction. And it wasn't simply a, you know, you're in a new place, new geography, new venue. It wasn't that. I mean, I knew that, but it was just, I had not been in that kind of physical environment, nor had I been in that kind of cultural or intellectual environment. But having run into Peter Lance made me feel much more comfortable. And at the same time, it made me think, my God, I mean, did I make the right decision? Should I be at Xavier now, as opposed to this campus? I had some doubts. I had some serious, serious doubts. It wasn't just about being homesick. You know, is this really what I'm bargaining for? Is this for me? So you have to really adjust quickly, really quickly, to those kinds of environments.
And how would you compare that day to your last day on campus, the day you graduated? How would you compare it?
I got this. I was much more comfortable. I navigated 4 years of that kind of Dartmouth experience. I made friends of all races. I'm out to conquer the world. I felt that I could be a mentor. the other incoming students. And that's why I took the job of an assistant to the dean, because I felt that I could lessen some of the barriers, some of the hurdles that I knew I had to go through. And it helped. So it took some students never did really get used to that kind of environment, Janelle. And so I felt that I had navigated it well enough to at least guide them through that, particularly incoming freshmen, both Black and white, but particularly Black students, because I could empathize with them.
Would you say you served as a mentor to the younger student body then?
That's a good term, yes. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't want them to come, feeling disillusioned or that they couldn't compete. And by the same token, I did not want them feeling that they could not take this seriously. You've got to take this seriously. I don't care what kind of background you come from, what sort of academic preparation you have. This is going to be challenging. So I don't want you coming here thinking that and with an inflated ego, because that ego would be pierced and deflated quickly. And then, you know, it made me humble because I had done well academically throughout my life. But when confronted with the environment at Dartmouth, everybody did well. Everybody was smart. You're not the only smart guy in the world. You know, to submit the student, you're just an average student among the student population. So I wanted to tell them, look, you're going to leave here and during your first year with a sense of humility, you know, that you're not such a prima donna that you thought you were, which is a good lesson.
In 1972, right after you graduated, the Congress passed the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution. How did this influence or impact the political climate you were in?
In 72, I was on campus. I think in 72, Title IX was enacted. The Civil Rights Bill was amended to include gender discrimination. It made me certainly feel more comfortable that, we were going to get to where we're supposed to be in this society, both from a local, state, national level, and on a campus level. So it gave us hope. It gave us what President Obama talked about a lot, and that was hope against adversity.
So you mentioned that.
And it made me want to be even more active as a civil rights attorney.
And how did
you? It made me want to be a lawyer. It made me decide then I'm going to be a lawyer.
And how did you decide on Tulane Law School to become a lawyer?
I was tired of the Northeast. I was tired of the cold weather. I was tired of the pretentiousness of parts of that environment. So I said, I'm getting out of here. I'm coming south either to UVA or to Tulane. And I went to practice law in Louisiana. So Tulane was the perfect place.
And what was practicing law like for the first time?
It was challenging, but I knew it was something that I wanted to do. And I easily evolved into that sort of thing. I started off with the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund in New York City with Jack Greenberg, whose predecessor was Thurgood Marshall. And I became immersed in civil rights litigation and constitutional litigation. And, you know, I accompanied lawyers. I did not try any cases. I didn't know how to try a case. But I accompanied lawyers who did, you know, around the country. And it instilled in me a greater sense of involvement, a greater sense of responsibility in doing that kind of, of work. And when I came home, I had a salary from the Legal Defense Fund, and I obtained a job as the first Black assistant DA, district attorney in my area. And I was allowed to practice. And my family members were here, people knew me. So it was a good ride financially. And I said, wow, this is really good. And as I told you before, you can't do good unless you do well. You can't help if you're struggling. So I avoided that. And I remember the first, it was 7 years from the time I came back. I tried my first capital murder case, defending. Now, I was not a prosecutor then, I was defending. Black guy in Lake Charles killed a white cop. That's not good. How do you pick a jury that's not going to be prejudiced against you? And we won an acquittal. Won an acquittal based on self-defense. And that really brought me a lot of visibility and a lot of business. And it wasn't just defending a guy and getting him off on a technicality. He really was innocent. That's the scary part. You're defending somebody you know is innocent, just not guilty. He's there was no intent to murder. No intent to murder. It was self-defense. And the first case I ever signed off on as a lawyer went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we won it 9-0 unanimously. It involved the First Amendment issue, and I did that with the assistance of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York. It was argued on the day that President Reagan was shot, in March 30th, 1981. I was 5 years out of law school, 6 years. You know, so it was a great experience for me.
You mentioned values of community, hard work, race, and just creating like unity. How did those values that you learned from Dartmouth, your values growing up with your siblings, factor into you being a judge and just practicing law?
I knew I didn't have to learn. Judges sometimes, you know, they voice platitudes. I'm going to be fair. You know, I'm going to be impartial. I already knew that. I knew that. I had lived that kind of experience, and you bring that kind of experience to the bench. It's not something where, okay, am I doing the right thing? I know what I'm doing the right thing because of my past experiences. The Sankofa bird of West Africa sees backward while it moves, while it flies forward. You know, it knows where it's going because it knows where it's been. And so I felt like the Sankofa bird. I know where I'm going because I know where I've been. And so the idea of being a judge and being fair to people was easy to me. It came naturally because that's what I did as a civil rights lawyer. That's what I did as a criminal defense lawyer. That's what I did as a personal injury lawyer. You know, getting money for people where insurance company would otherwise screw them. So I didn't let that happen under my watch. You know, so it was very easy for me to do. So yeah, I mean, I enjoyed doing it.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your experience working as the first Black DA at the time?
I made a front page of the paper. And now, let me tell you, so we got a long way to go, Janelle, but we've come a long way as well. Now it's unusual not to have Black prosecutors. So it's just a common thing now. It wasn't that common a thing back in 1976 in the Deep South and in Lake Charles, Louisiana. It gave me an idea of how to treat people fairly. It made me know that prosecuting is not about winning cases. Sure, you like to win. I never lost a case as a prosecutor because I didn't go to trial if I thought I couldn't win it. But it gave you a sense of, okay, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing this thing called justice? Is this police report really correct? Are you sure this is a correct report? And then the next day, you'd get a supplemental report which contradicted the first report. You knew that this report, the first report, was made up and you were lying. You knew that. And so you knew, as a private practitioner and as a lawyer and as a judge, you knew about the fallacies of the criminal justice system. You knew intimately how it worked inside out. And, you know, so it gave you not just a theoretical sense of, okay, what are the cases like? Or what are the precedents like? But it gave you a real sense of, this doesn't look good. Or this doesn't sound good. I know this cop is lying. You know, or by the same token, I know this, the defendant is lying. Or this is a hack, this is a story that was made up. Let me give you an example. I was an appeal court judge. I was never a trial judge. And as an appeal court judge, you're supposed to give a lot of deference, a lot of credibility to what the trial court has found, because the trial court sees the witnesses, sees the demeanor of the witnesses on the stand, sees their movements, and is able to process that. Well, guy gets hit in the head with a boom. This is a fishing, this is an industrial area, but it's also that the fishing industry is very big in Southwest Louisiana because of all the water. Boom hits him in the head. He suffers disabling injuries. His coworkers say that they didn't see it or know it didn't happen. Why? Because in the fishing industry, if you go with an accident-free season, you get a bonus. Okay? So they were tempted to say, oh, nothing happened. I didn't see that. It goes to trial and they change their story. Of course, they're not burdened by the employer-employee status. They're not working for this company anymore. So now they're free to tell what really happened. And they didn't know this guy. So they told what really happened. The trial judge ruled against this guy. And he said in his ruling that, I don't believe Mr. Thomas because he had to be subpoenaed to come to court. That's normal. And I don't believe Mr. Williams because he's on government assistance, he's on welfare. Okay, and both of these guys were poor. So he ruled against them. When it comes to us on appeal, it's very difficult to overcome those credibility determinations. It's hard because you're not there. You're just reading a cold record on appeal, black words on white paper. And the captain of that boat testified, and the first mate testified, and the trial judge believed the captain and the first mate. Well, I know, coming from Louisiana and coming from not very far from the Gulf of Mexico, that on a fishing boat, always the captain is white. Always the first mate is white. Always the workers are black. So what happened was he really believed the white captain and the first mate because of their race and disbelieved the black witnesses. So we overturned it on appeal because it wasn't in the record, but I know that from my experience. And this is the fair thing to do. My experience taught me that. And, you know, from a criminal standpoint as a judge, I knew pretty much, okay, you know, given what happened, this is an excessive sentence for what happened. So how do you correct that? And you find creative ways to correct that sort of thing. In a workers' compensation area, my dad worked as a common laborer. You miss one check and you're in trouble, okay? You live from one check, one payday to the other. So I was very conscious of workers' compensation cases and workers' compensation injuries. And I was very conscious and very aware that sometimes insurance companies will not do the right thing. And my wife is an State Farm insurance agent. And we don't talk too much about those things, okay? So I'm aware that people who are injured will work while injured because they can't afford to miss a check, okay? And so I'm also aware that how important this area of the law is. So I was very sympathetic to that area of the law because I knew my dad was a laborer. He worked with his hands every day. We can't afford to miss a check. And so I was not very sympathetic to those employers and those insurance companies that refused or failed to pay the appropriate workers' compensation benefits. So those are things that I brought to the bench because of my experiences at Dartmouth and because of my experiences as a practicing attorney for 17 years before I became a judge.
Speaking of Dartmouth, how would you describe the Title IX office?
Well, we had very little interaction because, remember, this was 1967 through 1971, and Title IX was almost non-existent. okay. Women solve the ball? What are you talking about? They should be in the home ec class. I mean, solve ball? No. Basketball? No. You know, so we didn't have those programs. Those programs existed, Janelle, after I left Dartmouth. And I think it makes for much more inclusive society. It makes much more for a normal society to have those Title IX programs. And of course, in these times when, because of the pandemic, those things are challenged because of schools, the incomes of schools are not as they were before, and the debt and the debt limits of those colleges are greater than they were. So something's got to give. Okay. So what do you do? Do you give up women's tennis that doesn't generate a whole bunch of money? Do you give up women's soccer? Do you give up women's softball? Because those are not income generating. Those are not revenue streams. And you keep men's football and basketball. So, like, where's the balance? And so now, because of Title IX, you got to be very careful about those things. You know, you got to have equity and you got to have parity. And so college administrators, private employers, you know, have to be very conscious of those things as well. So I think that was a really great addition. You know, it wasn't like James Brown said, it's a man's world. No, it's not anymore.
Speaking of, you mentioned that you met your wife at, your wife is from Xavier. How did you meet?
I was practicing law in here in Lake Charles, and she was working as an engineer for the phone company. And it was a cold day, unusual for Louisiana. And so my law partner saw her and offered her inside for a cup of coffee. And he said, I've got someone that you need to meet. And he introduced us that day. And she came in for a cup of coffee, and I drank a cup of coffee. And I was not a coffee drinker. It made me sick. But it was a good sickness. And I was feeling badly because of my allergies. And so, like, within the next couple of nights, you know, we had a date, even though I wasn't feeling well. So, yes, it was just fortuitous that she was planting fiber optics around my law office on a cold winter day. And my law partner decided to introduce her to me under the guise of coming in for a cup of coffee because it's a cold day.
That's so sweet. How is that dynamic?
I wasn't considering Xavier because she went to Xavier and graduated during the same year. I didn't even know her in high school. She went to a little ritzy Catholic school across town, and I went to a public high school.
That's crazy. You mentioned that she does state law insurance. How does, like, the arguments would, like, conflict when you're, like, preaching your law and, like, your techniques versus what she does for a living? How does that work out?
Yeah, it's a mutual company, so it's employee-owned, but she sells the policies. No, she's not an adjuster that adjusts damages. She just sends those over, okay? And it's something that we don't talk about too often. when I was on the bench, I wasn't a big fan of State Farm, and they didn't particularly like my decisions, even though knowing that my wife was a State Farm agent, you would think that, they would ask to recuse. They would be fortunate that I would be on a case involving State Farm because my wife is a State Farm agent. And so, no, they were not, I was not a fan of State Farm. And they were not a fan of me. And so it was, I don't care. And even today, you know, my law firm has over 650 hurricane-related cases, half of which are against State Farm. We call the company Snake Farm as opposed to State Farm. And she doesn't care. You know, as I said, she believes more in fairness than she does being obligated to a particular entity. So no, it doesn't create problems at all.
That's interesting. Another question. You said you own three charter schools. Can you speak more about what played into your decision of opening those schools, and do you foresee yourself opening more?
You know, I told you that I taught as part of the Tucker Foundation programs while at Dartmouth, and that made me more interested in education. Education exists, I think, for the purpose of closing the equity gap, closing the income gap, closing the educational gap that exists in our society. So I was part of a group called the 100 Black Men of Metro Lake Charles. And our purpose was to go out, one of our purposes was to go out and talk about leadership and to various public, to various students in our area, and to create opportunities for mentorship and to create a knowledge of economic equality and entrepreneurship. And we would go out, you know, once a week, perhaps an hour, and we'd select a school. And we weren't having an impact. We weren't having a systemic impact. And many of those students were there because their teachers told them to go, okay? And many of the principals allowed us to go because of who we were, not because they were interested in what we had to say. And so after a while, we thought, you know what? I think we're wasting our time. We're not having the impact, the systemic impact that we think we are having. So let's be honest with ourselves. So I explored ways to have a greater impact using the same amount of energy. And I thought about opening a charter school. And we have, I think, approximately 53 public schools in this parish. That includes pre-K through 8 and high school. And of the 53, 16 were failing or underperforming, okay? And all of them had at least an 85% Black population. That's not coincidental. So every failing or underperforming school in the parish, which you call a county, were Black. So I said, this can't be. And in our system, one has to go to the school where you're zoned. It's a neighborhood school. So I could not go to a school, to a better performing school out of the zone. If I had been growing up in Lake Charles at the time we established the schools in 2010, my elementary school would have been an F school. My middle school would have been a D school. My high school would have been a D school. I'm stuck in this zip code. I can't get out of it. A charter school doesn't exist that way. A charter school can accept applicants from the entire state if it wishes to. So I decided, let's form a charter school where parents have a choice of where they can send their children, where parents have a greater voice in school matters, and where we're not beholden to the bureaucratic ways of the local school board. And so that's the reason that I started that. I think we have a greater chance of overcoming what I call the equity gap than we do in the traditional high schools. America is the only place where billions of dollars are spent on a business, the business of education, and it's a failure. No, it would not allow any other business to spend that kind of money and fail. So we do more with less. So we have three charter schools. We have two pre-K through eight. We had exceeded our enrollment of 850 because of the hurricanes and because of COVID. And so we have an average population of 800 in the pre-K through eight, and we have 550 in the high school. So we're educating approximately 2,100 kids in our three charter schools, where we govern ourselves. We make the rules, and we don't have to be beholden to the bureaucracy of the traditional system. I'll give you just a small example. We're at a meeting, a school board meeting, and we're the school board. We are the school board, three schools. And so our principal says, I need something called Promethean boards. What the hell is Promethean board? I didn't know. So she explained what a Promethean board was, and we need some computers. We took her from the traditional public school system where she would have had to go through her supervisor, the supervisor had to go through his supervisor, and that supervisor had to go through an assistant principal, an assistant superintendent. Well, and that would have taken 3 or 4 months. And I asked, well, how much did that cost? They said, it's like $88,000. So we looked at the budget and said, oh, we can afford that. So in 10 minutes, as she had what she needed to educate these kids, as opposed to waiting 3 or 4 months. And so our school population generally consists of about 85% Black, and the rest white or Hispanic, 82% of whom are eligible for free lunch, free breakfast programs. So everybody gets to eat free. And they were not succeeding. No, they were succeeding. Schools were not succeeding. The schools were failing them. Same students, same parents, same zip code, same address. How come they're being successful in our schools? So that's why I started the schools. To give them the same advantage that I had growing up.
That's wonderful. And how would you compare like your school to like your high school and your classmates back then who didn't have those same resources that my generation would have today?
They were more committed and we had a better education. Yeah. The average Black high schooler in Louisiana reads at about the fifth grade level, okay? Because they're in schools, public schools, where there's tenure. So you stay in that school for 3 to 5 years, then you move on to better schools. Or you stay in that school, if you're an underperforming teacher, they can't get rid of you because you're tenured, okay? When I was in high school, we had teachers, many of whom were male, who were committed. They were very bright. We had the best of the best. Why? Because they couldn't go to law school. They couldn't go to engineering school. They couldn't go to medical school. Okay, so they graduated with education degrees and came to teach me. So I think we were getting a better education than the present seniors today.
You mentioned so much about teaching and all your experiences. Have you ever thought for a moment that maybe you want to do teaching full time instead of lawyer?
Yeah, I did, but I decided that's too hard. Teaching is very difficult. It's hard. And two, I can lecture as a lawyer and I can make a better living. I can do what I want to do from a social, political, and civic standpoint and make more money than a teacher can make. And that's why I admire teachers today. It's a difficult profession, particularly dealing with the kids of today. They're not as well behaved and they're not as respectful as we were. Okay. So yeah, I've thought about that. I've thought about that a lot of times. And I think my empathetic nature, I could have been a very good teacher. And it's very inspiring to see teachers teach. And I keep a saying in my desk drawer every day I look at it. And it's by Frederick Douglass. It says, it is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. It's so much easier to repair young boys and girls than it is to, I mean, to build young boys and girls than it is to repair broken men and women. And that's what education should be all about. And that's what our schools aspire to be. And I think we're accomplishing that.
And given that, what in your time at Dartmouth, what would you say or think would needed to be changed at Dartmouth, given the your focus on education and inclusiveness?
You know, there should be more of a pragmatic approach to dealing with societal issues. I know it's an academic institution, and you've got, you know, you're being taught a lot of concepts and a lot of theories. How do you put that in practice? So I think that Dartmouth and all higher educational institutions should look at the more pragmatic aspects of dealing with society. And I think it's a social responsibility. I think it's a social responsibility on their part that they should think about that. You should just identify what the problems are. Okay, how do you deal with that? How do you create institutions, concrete institutions, to deal with what you think are these social and economic and civic problems? So develop a more pragmatic approach. Mm-hmm. I think students ought to be thinking about that. Okay, I've talked and I've rapped and I've done all of this. So what are you going to do about it? You know, it's like Booker T. Washington said, it's not what you think, nor what you say. It's what you do that's going to define you. That's the essence of who you are, is what you do. And so you think, you say, well, I don't know what to do. No, you don't. No, you don't. So that's why the schools ought to give you some ideas of pragmatism. How do I develop programs to deal with the economic gap, to deal with the income gap, to deal with the educational gap? What are some programs that can be developed? How do you help me develop those programs? Or give me some ideas on what to do? That's what I think institutions, part of the institutions, should be about.
And if you could give advice to the Black students at Dartmouth today, what other advice would you give them?
Besides being pragmatic, enjoy life. Enjoy life. You know, don't wait until your golden years to try to enjoy those things that you've accumulated all of your younger years. Because by that time, you will not have the energy to do so, nor the willingness to do so. Life is made of memories, not material things. I'm not telling you to not enjoy or to get those material things. You know, you've got sneakers going for $600 these days. Golden Goose. Golden Goose and the Versaces. Accumulate those things. Accumulate the Bentleys and the Jaguars and the BMWs, but also make sure that your life is filled with good memories, and don't wait until your golden years, okay? To start enjoying those things that you've been able to accumulate. Now, make life happier and make life more productive. A happy person is a productive person. And so why should a 25-year-old not engage in pursuing his or her dreams and take a job where it might be financially inviting, but you hate it? Take your chances while you're young. You're going to make mistakes, but you're young enough to overcome those mistakes. So take those chances.
That is true. Well, thank you so much for your time and thoughtful considerations. This has been very impactful, yes.
Okay, Janelle, it was a pleasure talking to you. And, you know, I wish